Good evening, welcome. Thank you so much for joining tonight as we launch what is the second year, but the first installment of our series in which we take self-help productivity books, contemporary lessons of today, and try to communicate them and put them in a context of Torah and try to be able to draw from the wisdom of our time, but communicate and to place it in the context of great, our timeless Torah teachings. So tonight I want to share with you some insights from a book that it's not an exaggeration to say changed my life. I'm very far from a voracious reader, but I try to read and I love productivity books. I love business books, productivity books, things that help you, your vision, your juices flow, and entrepreneurial spirit. And occasionally I've read books or consumed books is probably a more accurate description that had such a deep and profound impact. They caused me for several days to not be able to stop thinking about it and to rethink parts of how I want to live my life. And I hope I'm not building this up too much, but I'll tell you that the book we're going to talk about and draw from tonight is one such book. The book is called The War of Art. It's a play on a earlier, much more famous book from many centuries, millennia ago, called The Art of War. And The War of Art is written by Stephen Pressfield. And I want to give you a moment of introduction of who Pressfield is before we tap into his wisdom and again suggest it in the context of Torah teachings, just to give you a sense of who Pressfield is. Stephen Pressfield did not wake up with a silver spoon in his mouth. He did not discover success early. He's not an individual who was prodigious or right from the start was able to break through. In his own words, he wrote 27 years before he got his first novel published. He wrote and he wrote and he wrote again, and all his writings were rejected by publishers for 27 years. Could you imagine dedicating yourself to something for 27 years? After the first year, the third year, the fifth year, after the first decade of being rejected, you might walk away and say, it's time for a career change. It's not even a career change because the career never got launched to begin with. But he stuck with it 27 years, and he published what was a book that was produced as a movie. You've probably heard of it, called The Legend of Bagger Vance. During that time, those 27 years, he describes he worked in 21 different jobs in 11 different states. He taught high school, he drove tractor trailers, he worked in advertising, a screenwriter in Hollywood, he worked in offshore oil rigs, he picked fruit as a migrant worker. For one season, he lived in a house that was $15 a month, no water, no doors, and no windows. At one point, he was homeless, and he was living in his car. And why do I share that critical background about him with you? Because as we explore the wisdom of his book, I want you to understand that this is not, again, somebody who was born with great success, who never struggled, who never knew what it meant or what it was like to have to overcome. This is an individual who is speaking from very personal experience. He's drawing from his own autobiography, his life story, and he's enabling us to tap into it and to grow from there. I'll also tell you that I didn't fully appreciate this the first time I read it or shared about it, but Stephen Pressfield is a Jew. Now, he has a remarkable story as a Jew. Again, we don't have a lot of time tonight, and I want to share with you mostly from his book. But his parents kept from him that he was a Jew until he was 13 years old. They were ashamed. They were embarrassed to a degree. They were themselves anti-Semitic, self-hating Jews in the classic sense. And it was only at 13 years old that he discovered that he was a Jew. And he decided, if I'm Jewish, I might as well explore what that means. I might as well be a Jew. So he started going, in his words, to temple. He found a synagogue. There was none in his hometown. So he hitchhiked to the next town. And the reason he had to hitchhike is because his mother and father refused to drive him. So embarrassed were they about their Judaism. And so desperately did they not want him to pursue his journey of Jewish discovery. However, and this is a tragic footnote to this story. However, at the synagogue, he felt rejected. He was an outsider. He couldn't afford to buy tickets. He didn't speak Hebrew. He had never had a bar mitzvah, even though he was 13 years old. He had never heard what Hanukkah was. And so instead of being welcomed with open arms and with warmth, instead of being brought in, he felt like he was rejected. He felt like he was rejected, so he gave it up. And when he rediscovered his Judaism was in 1967, the Six-Day War, when Israel was walking on water, walking on air, and Israel defeated in this record time, and the whole world was looking at the Jew as this powerful figure, he decided that he had to renew his sense of Judaism, and he wrote a book about that Six-Day War and its impact on his life. You may have heard the book. It's also an excellent book, worthy of review another time, Stephen Pressfield, called The Lion's Gate. The Lion's Gate, which is the story of the Six-Day War, and it's really worth reading. So with that background, I want to share with you, and if you email me offline, I will send you these source sheets that have the excerpts of the book that we're going to share tonight. But I want to share with you the beginning of Pressfield's book. I want to share with you the introduction. Here's what he writes. Listen carefully. He writes, most of us have two lives, the life we live and the unlived life within us. And between the two stands resistance. That is the title, the name he's going to give for the voice that self-sabotages, for the obstacle, the resistance that stands in our way. See, Pressfield, and who knew this from personal experience of 27 years of failure, 27 years of flopping, 27 years of rejection, Pressfield knew that there was a potential inside him, someone who he was meant to be, things he was meant to accomplish, a difference he was meant to make, and yet he kept hitting a wall. It wasn't happening. If you're anything like me, every night I go to sleep and I say, maybe I got things done today, but it wasn't nearly the day I meant or wanted to have. When I woke up, I had dreams, I had ambition, I had aspirations, things I was going to get done. And yet the end of the day always seems to come up short. You reflect at the end of a quarter, you reflect at the end of the year, we're in Elul counting down to Rosh Hashanah, and we're looking back on the year, and we're looking back on yet another year. And did we meet our goals religiously in our Torah learning, in our appreciation of davening, in our relationships? Did we meet our goals in our career, in our profession, in our finances? Did we meet our goal in our health, in our wellness, and our well-being? Often, if not, everybody falls up short, comes up short. And the question is why? So Pressfield gives this phenomenon a name. He describes there's the life we live, the reality of our daily life, and there's the unlived life within us. You know, the unlived life within us is when you are having coffee with a close friend, with a spouse, with someone you trust, and you confide in them about your dreams and aspirations. Maybe are things you don't even tell anybody, but in your own mind, it's a picture of who you could and are meant to be. That's the unlived life inside us. And the barrier that blocks between the two is what he calls resistance. Have you ever brought home a treadmill and let it gather dust in the attic? Ever quit a diet, a course of yoga, a meditation practice? Have you ever bailed out on a call to embark upon a spiritual practice, dedicate yourself to a humanitarian calling, commit your life to the service of others? Have you ever wanted to be a mother, a doctor, an advocate for the weak, and help us to run for office, crusade for the planet, campaign for world peace, or preserve the environment? Late at night, you experienced a vision of the person you might become, the work you could accomplish, the realized being you were meant to be. As you are you a writer who doesn't write, a painter who doesn't paint, an entrepreneur who never starts a venture? Then you know what resistance is. Resistance, he writes, is the most toxic force on the planet. It is the root of more unhappiness than poverty and disease. Resistance, feeling like a failure, coming up short, being rejected, living as underachievers of who we could or are meant to be. It is the root of more unhappiness, he says, than poverty and disease. To yield to resistance deforms our spirit. It stunts us. It makes us less than we are and we were born to be. Again, he goes on and on. I wish I could literally just read the whole book to you straight. That would be the whole talk tonight because the book is so beautifully captures. He writes, I looked everywhere for the enemy and failed to see it right in front of my face. You see, the thing about resistance, and we'll talk more about this momentarily, is while we want to point and blame others, if I had a different spouse, if I had different parents, if my teachers were different, if my boss were, if my rabbi were different, if there were no corona, if there were no this, if there were no that, we can blame and point fingers and cop out and rationalize. But he says if we're honest, we realize that that voice of resistance, the enemy, that which is holding us back and blocking our path, it is in fact right in front of our face. It's inside ourselves. Is that what it takes? Or he writes here, have you heard the story? Woman learns she has cancer, 6 months to live. Within days she quits her job, resumes the dream of writing songs she gave up to raise a family. The woman's friends think she's crazy. She herself has never been happier. There's a postscript. The woman's cancer goes into remission. Is that what it takes? Do we have to stare death in the face to make us stand up and confront resistance? At the end of the introduction, he writes, look in your own heart. Unless I'm crazy right now, a small, still voice is piping up, telling you as it has 10,000 times the calling that is yours and yours alone. And my dear friends, that's what I want to talk to you about tonight. What is that still small voice that is popping up that tells you as it has 10,000 times the calling that is yours and yours alone? Why haven't we give up? Why haven't we walked away? And why do we still have dreams, ambition, and aspiration? Why do we still have a vision and a picture of who we could be, even though resistance stands in our way? And the answer is there is a still small voice that is piping up. And when I first read this book, the words of the Navi jumped off the page to me, of the kol demama daka, of that small still voice. The kol demama daka, the Mefarshim explain, is none other than the Tzelem Elokim. This is a description of the godly soul, the godly spirit that God placed inside us. There is a Tzelem Elokim. There is a voice, there is a presence, there is the echo of the Almighty that is resonating in us and resonates through us and should reverberate out to the world. There is potential, if we can defeat that resistance, to be ambassadors and agents, to be angels of the Almighty, to shape and mold and to repair His world. It's who we are meant to be and what we are meant to accomplish. There is that still small voice, that kol demama daka, that tzelem Elokim, the godliness that has capability, the godliness of competence, the godliness that with no excuses, with discipline and self-regulation, the godliness of time management and punctuality, the godliness that doesn't procrastinate, the godliness that follows through and gets it done from beginning to end, the godliness that we're meant to contribute to the world, the kol demama daka. Pasuk says in Bereishis, Vayitzer Hashem Elokim es Adam Afram min Adama, God fashioned man from the earth of the ground, Vayipach be'apav, and He breathed into us, Nishmas Chayim, the soul of life, Vayi Adam l'nefesh Chaya, we became animated, we became alive, we became God's partner in this world. He invited us to partner with Him in repairing the world in His image and according to His vision. And every one of us has a unique and distinct mission and calling that no one else, not the billions who came before us or the billions who will come after or the billions who live contemporaneous to us, nobody else can contribute what we are meant to. There's a kol demama daka, there is a tzelem Elokim. And the only question is whether we will allow resistance to stand in our way or whether we will express our free will. Rav Kook, the first chief rabbi of Israel, before he ever moved to Israel, wrote a book called the Nevuchei Ador, a book called For the Perplexed of the Generation. And in the very introduction of this book, he writes, the foundation of the Torah, Sha'adam Nivra B'Tzelem Lokim, Zeu Yisod HaTorah. If you give up on yourself, if you think you're no different than an animal, that there is no afterlife, that you haven't been here since before time, if you don't think that God speaks and breathes through you, and that there is a godliness in you, then you've given up on others, you've given up on yourself, you've given up on this world, you've defeated the purpose of creation. Ha'adam nivra b'tzelem hu yisod ha'Torah, this is the core, the source, the foundation of Torah. Ikim ikar ha'tzelem hu ha'chofei zogomar shanu mutzim ba'adam sha'akein hu ba'al b'chira. And what does it mean that we have a godliness inside us? What it means is that we are steadfast and we hold true to the notion that we have free will, that we have choice. I wrote about it in my article this week, how challenging it is to live today and to look around and to see people who are more strict and people who are more too lenient and to be so filled with anxiety and discomfort and disappointment and frustration, to not know what we should be doing, but yet to feel judgment for what others are doing, how complicated it is to be alive, to second guess the policies of institutions and organizations and schools and shuls, and even to second guess ourselves, how difficult it is to not have those feelings and those reactions and those responses to the people and the things and the stimuli and the nature around us. And yet Rav Kook reminds us that we are a baal bechira, that we have free will, that we have choice, that we don't have to give other people real estate in our brain and in our mind. We don't have to give them the key to our reaction, to our heart, that we can control how they make us feel, that we can still control ourselves in a world of powerlessness and in a world where increasingly we feel there are fewer things we can control. We can still control and we must still control ourselves. We are the baalei habechira. We have to learn to overcome that voice of resistance. We have to learn to regulate and to be disciplined and sovereign over ourselves so that we can be, in fact, God's agents and His partners to make that difference in His world. So let's go through His insights. Again, I'm going to read to you some selections. I want you to know this entire book you could read in one sitting, maybe two. It's short. It's little passages, but each one packs a punch. And if you want meaningful topics to talk about with your family, at your Shabbos table, over this coming Yontif, take a section, a little selection, read it, and each one is so powerful. So for example, he writes the following. This is a chapter, it's two sentences. We are wrong if we think we're the only ones struggling with resistance. Everyone who has a body experiences resistance. He has a very Jewish soul. He doesn't even understand that he's actually communicating our timeless Torah through his words. This is what he says. Don't think that you're alone. Don't think that everyone else, they've got it together. They're not tempted to look or say or go or do the wrong thing. Everyone else so has it together. And me, I'm the only one. I'm a lazy, good-for-nothing, isvarf bum. I procrastinate and I delay and I push off and I hit the snooze 400 times and I surf the web and I never get to what I'm meant to do and I don't check the things off my list. And I'm the only reject in this world. Everyone else has it so together. He says, if you have a body, you confront resistance. For some, resistance takes the form of eating and health. And for others, it's other temptation and desire. And for others, it's underachieving in the world of career. For others, it's underachieving academic or intellectually. Everyone is struggling with resistance. If you have a body, you've experienced resistance. What do I mean he's intuited our Torah? Because Torah tells us that only an angel, namely, only the being who has no body is perfect, has no yetzahara, has no temptation, has no voice of self-sabotage. Only the angel. But to be a human being, Torah already tells us that yetzalev ha'adam rami ne'urav, we were created and we were born with this voice. We have these dual voices in our head. We have this tension that we live with. We are given this resistance in order to overcome it because it makes it so sweeter, so much more beautiful. We can celebrate the success in such a greater way. But to be alive, to have a body, means to confront resistance. The Gemara in Sukkah and Daf Nun Beis tells us, there are seven names to the Yetzihara. This Yetzihara, you know, when we were little kids, the picture painted of the Yetzihara was the devil with the pitchfork sitting on one shoulder and the angels on the other shoulder. And like, which way are we going to turn? Who are we going to listen to? Who's going to tell us, do your homework, don't do your homework, hide the thing, sneak out, do the... But that's of course not the Yetzihara. The Yetzihara is not external to ourselves. The Yetzihara is that internal voice. The Yetzihara is inside ourselves. The Yetzihara is that alter ego that says, you know, Yom Kippur is coming up, then Tzom Gedalia, you're going to be fasting. You could eat the ice cream. You could eat the Trader Joe's corn chips. You could eat the entire bag. You know, you didn't sleep, whatever, so it wouldn't kill you. Sleep a little bit late, Miss Minion, but you deserve... There's this voice. It's not external to ourselves. It's not a little devil on the... You know, you could say the Lashon Hara because really the person needs to know because it's for their own good and really you're helping and you have to and you're doing a favor. The Yetzirah has seven voices. And the sources tell us that what it means that the Yetzirah has seven voices, Rav Yitzchak Blazer in Koch Veor, one of the great fathers of the Musar movement, Rav Yitzchak Blazer, 1837 to 1907, he writes, what this Gemara means is Hashiva Shemas and Shiva Kochus, Asher Behem Yenegach Afse Aretz, Lavi Lev Ha'adam Me'achare Hashem. The seven names of the Yetzirah means seven methodologies of the Yetzirah. There are seven strategies of the Yetzirah. You know that voice inside ourselves, it can get us, and it can sabotage us, and it can compromise us in so many different ways. It can do it by building us up. It can do us by knocking us down. It can do it by distracting us so that we are so overwhelmed and pressured, we don't even notice its pernicious path. There are seven ways, seven strategies, seven names to this Yetzirah, which is out to get us. It's out to get us. And so we have to stare. As Pressfield says, we shouldn't have to stare death in the face to make us stand up to resistance. We should have that ability to stand up and fight it even before. That line also struck me, certainly as we prepare for the Yom Noraim and for Yom Kippur. Because Yom Kippur in many ways is a dress rehearsal for death. On Yom Kippur we wear a kittel, the very garment we will be buried in. On Yom Kippur we read about the Asara Harugei Malchus, the 10 martyrs. On Yom Kippur we recite Vidui, the only other time we say Vidui is on a deathbed. On Yom Kippur we read Acharei Mos, after the death. On Yom Kippur, we don't eat or drink. We are alive, but we are as if not among the living. All of these things resemble and they imitate. They are a dress rehearsal. Literally, the men who wear a kittel are wearing what we will be buried in. It is quite literally a dress rehearsal for our deaths. Why? Why on Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the year, do we spend 25 hours with a dress rehearsal for our own death? And the answer is because death inspires life. The Gemara Brachos Daf Hei Amud Beis, the Olam Yargizu Adam Yetzer Tov Al Yetzahara. A person should always try to emphasize their good voice, their powerful voice, over their negative one. And if it doesn't work, go learn Torah. And if that doesn't work, recite Shema. And if that doesn't work, think about your mortality. Think about mortality. Think about coronavirus. People, otherwise healthy people, diagnosed, struck down within a few days, gone from this world. How tragic and how permanent and how all the money in the world couldn't stop this virus. All the money in the world couldn't invent a medicine that could heal. All the money in the world couldn't insulate or protect. All the money in the world couldn't stop. Person has to think about that day of death, confront our mortality, recognize just how finite, how limited and temporary we are here on earth, and that should inspire us to finally live. That's what Pressfield writes. It shouldn't be that we have to think about our day of death in order to be able to start to overcome resistance, in order to take it on. He writes, resistance cannot be seen, touched, heard, or smelled. But it can be felt. We experience it as an energy field, radiating from a work in potential. It is a repelling force. It's negative. Its aim is to shove us away, distract us, prevent us from doing our work. Pressfield is so perfectly, so eloquently and articulately, so aptly describing the Yetzirah. What we call the Yetzirah is exactly what he is calling resistance. Resistance is invisible. The Yetzirah comes from the phrase, the imagination, the Yetzer, Hara. It is the imagination of the heart of man. The imagination is the story that we tell ourselves. The Yetzirah is not visible. We can't find it. We can't point to it. We can't imprison it. We can't extinguish it. Yetzer, it is Miatzer. We've created it within our own mind. The Yetzirah is the result. It is the consequence of our imagination. Our rabbis tell us that the eye sees and then the heart longs and then the Yetzirah kicks in. So he writes, the Yetzirah is invisible, and he's exactly right. It's invisible. It's a figment of our imagination. We have imagined it, and then it goes to work on us. Pressfield writes, resistance seems to come from outside ourselves. We locate it in spouses, jobs, bosses, kids, peripheral opponents, as Pat Riley used to say when he coached the Los Angeles Lakers. Resistance is not a peripheral opponent. Resistance arises from within. It is self-generated and self-perpetuated. Resistance is the enemy within. As I said, we're tempted to want to point to others and to blame others and to say, if only I had a different upbringing, childhood, different IQ, athletic ability, if only I had a different spouse or different children, if I only had a different job, if only I had lived in a different community, if only I had different neighbors, if only I had an inspiring rabbi, if only I had, then I would be. Resistance tries to convince us. The internal resistance tries to convince us that the enemy is from without, but the truth is the enemy is absolutely coming from within. The Nesiv HaShalom, Rav Shalom Noach Berzovsky, the Slonim Rebbe on last week's Parsha on Kiseitzei, 2 weeks ago, Kiseitzei la milchama lo ivecha. First of all, the Or HaChaim HaKadosh says it doesn't say Kiseitzei le milchama, when you go out to a war, but with a patach, Kiseitzei la milchama, when you go to the war. There's a war every one of us battle. There's a battle every one of us face, and we do it every single day. And it's within ourselves. It's with ourselves. It should have said Kisi Lachem Be'oivecha, not Aloivecha. It's Aloivecha because we are fighting ourselves. Listen to the words of the Slonim Rebbe. He writes, Azen Nemar Aloivecha, Perish, Ha'oyev Ha'mayuchad Shelcha. Resistance is your enemy. I'm looking at some dear friends here on Zoom and YouTube and Facebook while we learn together tonight. And I want you to know your enemy is not mine and mine is not yours. None of us know the inner world of the other. Maybe we overlap and maybe we have some common enemies. Maybe you also have kryptonite, Trader Joe's corn chips. Maybe we overlap. We have some common enemies, but we have no idea the demons in each other's minds and hearts. We don't know that resistance. We don't know what's blocking us. We don't know the insecurities. We don't know the upbringing. We don't know the psyche. We don't know the psychohistory. We don't know. Al oivecha, oivecha shelcha. Stop comparing your competition. Stop comparing your tension or your enemy with another. It is unique to each and every one of us. Every one of us, this is our mission. Ki seitzei la milchama al oivecha, that resistance, that war is not with the people around us. That war is with and within ourselves. And only when we accept that and recognize that, only when we take on that challenge and address it in that way and name it that way, will we defeat it? He writes, Pressfield, the war of art. He writes, resistance will tell you anything to keep you from doing your work. It will perjure, fabricate, falsify, seduce. It will bully, cajole. Resistance is protean. It will assume any form, if that's what it takes to deceive you. It will reason with you like a lawyer or jam a 9mm in your face like a stick-up man. Resistance has no conscience. It will pledge anything to get a deal, then double-cross you as soon as your back is turned. If you take resistance at its word, you deserve everything you get. Resistance is always lying. Resistance, he says, is insidious. It will do anything it takes. That resistance has one job and one job only. That voice of resistance, the resistance in us, has only one mission, and that is to stop us, to block us, to sabotage us, to corrupt us, to convince us that we can't do whatever it is we want to do. And I am intentionally tonight leaving ambiguous what those missions and goals should be. I leave them for you to set for yourself. Where do you want that breakthrough? Where do you want to plow right through that resistance and overcome it to come out on the other end? In your relationship with others, with Hashem, in your davening, in your learning, in your observance of halacha? Where is it professionally, in your health and wellness? I leave it to you to decide. Tonight we're talking in broad strokes, but unless we understand these terms, if we understand and name the enemy, we cannot defeat it. It is insidious. The Gemara in Yuma on Daf Pei Vav tells us, Omer Avuna kevan she'avar adam aver v'shina bo hutzra lo. Hutzra lo asaka daitecha e manasis lo keheter. Such a profoundly wise Gemara. What insight to the human psyche. The Gemara is telling you if you violate an avera, you do something wrong, and then you repeat it. The first time you did it, there was guilt. The first time you did it, there was shame. The first time you did it, you felt bad. But by the second time, the third time you do it, it becomes permissible. You've rationalized, you've justified, you've explained to yourself, says the Gemara, that it's something that's not only not forbidden, it's permissible, you're allowed to. And then the Gemara says, by the third time you've done it, you've turned it into a mitzvah. You've turned it into a mitzvah. It's that juicy Lashon Hara. First time you said the Lashon Hara, you felt guilty, you really felt bad, you talked about another person. But the second time, you thought it was okay. In this situation, in this circumstance, it's justified. And by the third time, no, this is a mitzvah to tell this thing over. It's a mitzvah to communicate this. Essentially, what the Gemara tells us, like Pressfield described, it will perjure, fabricate, falsify, seduce, bully, cajole. It will do whatever it needs to. It will take on any form. It will convince us in any way. Listen to this next insight he has. So far, he's defining the Yetzer Hara. I want to finish his definition. Again, we're just quoting excerpts. It's worth it. You have to read the whole book. And then I want to get to his methodology of how to defeat the resistance, because if we've just named the enemy, but we haven't talked about how to defeat it, then we're only halfway through the battle. He writes, like a magnetized needle floating on a surface of oil, resistance will unfailingly point to true north, meaning that calling or action it most wants to stop us from doing. We can use this. Resistance is trying to block us. Where we feel and sense the greatest resistance or blockage, on the one hand, is an obstacle. It's holding us back, but on the other hand, we can use it. Use it as a compass. We can navigate by resistance, letting it guide us to that calling or action that we must follow before all others. Here's the rule of thumb, he writes. The more important a call or action is to our soul's evolution, the more resistance we will feel toward pursuing it. Let me repeat that. The more important a call or action is to our soul's evolution, the more resistance we will feel toward pursuing it. The more it is toward shaping our soul, the more meaningful it is to lifting us and enriching us and help us realize who we're meant to be and why we're here, the more resistance will jump up and try to block us. You ever try to do something truly noble? Did you ever have that big idea? Did you ever try to take on that really ambitious project? Did you ever feel a real sense of fire to transform yourself? That's when resistance will rise, and it'll rise with a fury. It'll rise to try to block us. But he says so precious, so brilliantly, that we can use that resistance, use that voice of resistance as a compass to guide us. And here I draw your attention to a pasuk in Tehillim Kuf Yud Tes. The pasuk says, "Me'oivai techakmeni mitzvosecha ki li'olam hi li." Me'oivai techakmeni. Your commandments make me wiser than my enemies. They always stand by me, is the pasuk. But in fact, there's a different way to understand it. Me'oivai techakmeni, Rabbi Yankel Galinsky explains, means me'oivai, from my enemy, techakmeni. I can gain great wisdom. You want to know where you have the greatest potential? Then identify where you have the strongest resistance. If you could figure out what's holding you block, in which area of your life are you confronting the strongest resistance, it is the compass that will also reveal to you where your greatest potential. Me'oivai, use that enemy. From that enemy you can learn. The Dalai Lama said, the enemy is a very good teacher. The enemy is a great, great teacher. Rav Meir Shapiro, the great founder of the Yeshivas Chochmei Lublin in Lublin, Poland, he writes, the same zeal, the same passion, the same enthusiasm, the same energy that we use to run towards what's wrong, we now know we have within us to be able to drive us to run towards what is right. We have that capability. We have that capacity. We can go in that direction. Next section, he writes, resistance's goal is not to wound or disable. Resistance aims to kill. Its target is the epicenter of our being, our genius, our soul, the unique and priceless gift we were put on earth to give and that no one else has but us. Resistance means business. When we fight it, we are in a war to the death. Resistance is not just trying to make you trip or stumble. Resistance is not trying to delay you or hold you back. Resistance aims to kill. It's trying to take you out. Its target is our genius, our soul, the unique and priceless gift we were put on earth to give that no one has but us. Is that not another translation for Tzelem Elokim? It is trying to take out, to extinguish the Tzelem Elokim so that we don't believe in ourselves, that we feel helpless and hopeless, that we don't take responsibility for our own lives, that we don't believe that we're capable of making change. It's trying to kill, it's trying to take us out. The Pele Yoetz writes, Hein emesh yitzur shel adam is gaber alav b'chol yom u'mevakesh. Hamito, The Yetzirah is fighting you every day. And not only is it fighting you every day, it is trying to kill you every day. It is trying to knock you down, take you out, make you hopeless. It's trying to make you stop believing in who you could be and stop believing that you can make lasting and real changes in your life. Do you know how resistance works? Pressfield writes, "Procrastination is the most common manifestation of resistance because it's the easiest to rationalize. We don't tell ourselves, 'I'm never going to write my symphony.' Instead, we say, 'I'm going to write my symphony. I'm just going to start tomorrow.'" You understand? You know how resistance takes its form in so many of us? Listen, resistance takes its form through procrastination. Why? Resistance doesn't say, "I'm never getting on the treadmill. I'm never going to start jogging. I'm never going to change my diet." Resistance doesn't say, "You're never going to start the daf yomi. You're never going to make it to davening with a minyan. You're never going to understand the words of the sitter." Resistance doesn't say, "I'm never going to be more patient and slow to anger and not be envious." Resistance says, no, you're going to be all those things. Just start tomorrow. Have we not all turned our treadmills or Pelotons into clothing racks? Have we not all at the supermarket said, "You know, what's the point anyway? The Yom Tovim are coming up. I'll start the diet after Yontif." The whole methodology of resistance is to take the form of procrastination. You see, if it would attack us head on, if it would reveal itself right before our eyes, we'd be able to navigate and manipulate around it. But by resistance being so secretive, so strategic, it therefore is so sly that it seeps right into our psyche. It tells us, no, you're going to do all those great things. You're going to achieve them. You're going to change. And it's going to be you. Let's just start tomorrow. We'll start tomorrow. And that's exactly how it works. It's exactly how it works. Yanka Galinsky in his Vigadita tells us, Hashem held the mountain over our head and he told us, accept the Torah. And if not, Shom Tehekvu Raschem. And all the Mefarshim ask on that Gemara in Shabbos, the Gemara in Shabbos and Peches, and Avodah Daf Beis, they ask, what do you mean Shom Teh? There will be your burial. Here will be your burial. God held the mountain over our head. He said, take the Torah, if not, you're going to die where? Not there, but here. He's going to drop the mountain. So instead of Yanko Glinsky, no. Shom. Shom Tehek Vuraschem means, not po, not here. Yesh Kvura, there's a death and a burial. Shenikra Shom. It's called there. When I get there, I'll do it. When I retire, I'll do it. In the summer, when things slow down, I'll do it. When I have an empty nest and the kids are out of the house, I'll do it. Shom, there. When that milestone happens, when that day on the calendar happens, when the season changes, when shom, there, that's when I'm going to start. Resistance works by telling us not that you're not going to do it, but let's start tomorrow. We'll get there. I felt very validated when I was searching after I read this book, and I said, wow, Pressfield has so articulately expressed exactly what the Yetzirah is. He gave it an English name. I no longer translate the word Yetzirah as the evil urge, the evil voice. Yetzirah, the new translation is resistance. The Yetzirah is the resistance. If you have a body, you've confronted resistance. There's the unlived life inside us and the life we're living, and between the two stands, resistance. It now has a name. It's called resistance. So I Googled. I was curious. Has anyone else made a connection between the word resistance and Yetzirah? And lo and behold, who made that connection? Who did I find? A man by the name of Stephen Pressfield. Pressfield himself, when he rediscovered his Judaism, he wrote an article in his blog, stephenpressfield.com. And he writes, in Jewish mysticism, the negative force that equates to resistance is called the Yetzirah. In Kabbalistic thought, the soul, neshama, in Hebrew is a divine and entirely good force that seeks to communicate with us on the material plane to our benefit. Kabbalists say that above every blade of grass is an angel whispering, grow, grow. But there's a catch. Between us and the neshama stands an entirely negative force, the Yetzirah, a.k.a. resistance, whose solitary aim is to block the soul from communicating with us and us from communicating with our soul. That is the turning toward evil, the built-in creation impulse, even compulsion to self-obstruction and self-destruction. And he goes on and on. Resistance is insidious. Resistance is implacable. Resistance is indefatigable. Resistance is shape-shifts. It lies. It dissembles. It aims to destroy us, body and soul. I felt so validated that he himself connected the two. The Yetzirah, its translation is resistance. Resistance. Resistance blocks us in so many other ways. Listen to the next section. He writes, if you find yourself criticizing other people, you're probably doing it out of resistance. When we see others beginning to live their authentic selves, it drives us crazy if we've not lived out our own. I love this insight. Listen carefully. If you find that you're hypercritical, if you find that you're seeing what's wrong in everyone else, then really what it's likely doing, it's the voice of resistance. When we see others beginning to live their authentic selves, it drives us crazy if we've not lived out our own. Individuals who are realized in their own lives almost never criticize others. If they speak at all, it is to offer encouragement. Watch yourself. Of all the manifestations of resistance, most only harm ourselves. Criticism and cruelty harm others as well. So most of the expressions or manifestations of resistance, they only block us, they only hold us back, they only hurt us. But when resistance takes on the form of the manifestation of criticism, then it's cruel. It harms others. And what a brilliant insight that people who are hypocritical are probably feeling very deficient or empty in their own right and in their own selves. I put up an article today. I wrote a new article and I began it with a story of a young couple that moved into a new neighborhood. And the next morning while they were eating breakfast, the young woman saw her neighbor hanging the laundry outside. She said that laundry is not very clean. She doesn't know how to do the wash correctly. Maybe she's using the wrong soap. Nobody ever taught her. So the husband looked on and he remained silent. Every time her neighbor hung her wash out to dry, the young woman made the same comment. A month later, the woman was surprised to see a nice clean wash on the line. And she said to her husband, "Look, she's finally learned how to wash correctly. I wonder who taught her." So the husband looked at his young wife and he said, "I got up early this morning and I cleaned our windows." In other words, when we look out at others and we criticize, when we judge others, our judgment doesn't actually say much about them. The judgment says everything about us. We have to clean our windows before we look through them and offer criticism and opinions about others. When we criticize, it's the voice of resistance really inside ourselves. The Gemara Baba Basra says, "Kshor atzmacha v'achakach kshor achirim." Be truthful with yourself. Be honest with yourself. Look in the mirror yourself before you begin to launch into criticism of others. He continues, "Resistance is fear. But resistance is too cunning to show itself naked in this form. Why? Because if resistance lets us see clearly that our own fear is preventing us from doing our work, we may feel shame at this, and shame may drive us to act in the face of fear. Resistance doesn't want us to do this, so it brings in rationalization. Rationalization is resistance's spin doctor. It's resistance's way of hiding the big stick behind its back. Instead of showing us our fear, resistance presents us with a series of plausible rational justifications for why we shouldn't do our work. What's particularly insidious about rationalizations that resistance presents to us is that a lot of them are true. They're legitimate. Our wife may really be in her 8th month of pregnancy. She may, truth, need us at home. Our department may really be instituting a changeover that will eat up hours of our time. Indeed, it may make sense to put off finishing our dissertation at least until after the baby's born. What resistance leaves out, of course, is that all this means diddly. Tolstoy had 13 kids when he wrote. Resistance takes on that form of rationalization. And the reason it's effective and the reason it works is because often it's even true. Often it's even real. It's a beautiful kliyakar, but we have to move along. We don't have time. And then he gets to the solution. And that's what I really want to share with you in our last few minutes tonight before we all buckle down and get ready for another amazing episode of Behind the Bima. Resistance. Resistance, fear, rationalizations, resistance and criticism, resistance and procrastination, resistance and our compass, resistance is internal, resistance is invisible, resistance is inside us. Anything with a body confronts resistance. If we want to live our best life, the unlived life inside us to become the life that we're living, then we need to learn how to defeat resistance. And when I read his description, I was simply blown away. Listen carefully. Aspiring artists defeated by resistance share one trait. They all think like amateurs. They've not yet turned pro. The moment an artist turns pro is in Epaco as the birth of his first child. With one stroke, everything changes. I can state absolutely that the term of my life can be divided into two parts, before turning pro and after. To be clear, when I say professional, I don't mean doctors and lawyers, those of the professions. I mean the professional as an ideal. The professional, in contrast to the amateur, consider the differences. The amateur plays for fun. The professional plays for keeps. To the amateur, the game is his avocation. To the pro, it's his vocation. The amateur plays part-time, the professional full-time. The amateur is a weekend warrior. The professional is there 7 days a week. The word amateur comes from the Latin root meaning to love. The conventional interpretation is that the amateur pursues his calling out of love, while the pro does it for the money. But it's not the way I see it, writes Pressfield. In my view, the amateur does not love the game enough. If he did, he would not pursue it as a sideline distinct from his real vocation. The professional loves it so much he dedicates his life to it. He commits full time. That's what I mean when I say turning pro. Resistance hates it when we turn pro. The answer to overcoming resistance, the method, the strategy, the beginning, the launch to be able to overcome the resistance in our lives is to turn professional, is to go pro. You know, with all these areas where we're lackadaisical, that we're casual, all the areas that we compromise, all the areas we're corrupt, all the areas that we promise and we dream and there's an unlived life inside us, we have an amateur attitude towards it. Are we serious about taking care of our health and wellness? Are we a professional about it? Do we have a nutritionist? Do we speak to a doctor? Do we have a trainer? Do we come up with a scheme? Do we hold ourselves accountable? Do we have a plan on how we're going to learn Torah and become a Talmud Chacham? How we're going to conquer areas of Torah learning? Do we tackle davening in a meaningful way by listening to the Siddur snippets or studying the Siddur on our own by really dedicating the time and disconnecting from the things that distract us? Are we ready to take on our relationships to be the spouse and the parent? Are we ready to set goals within our career and our profession? Are we ready to quit being amateurs and to start turning pro? 27 years of failure, 27 years of flopping, 27 years of rejection. And Pressfield says, you know what made the difference? And now he's published countless books. He's a world famous author. He's broken through. And you know what made the difference? He was homeless living in a car when he saw himself and lived as an amateur, part-time, an avocation. And when he turned pro is when his life turned around. Whatever it is we want to work on, whatever it is we want to change, are we amateurs or are we pros? Is it something we do on the side or does it define who we are? Is it something which is a corollary to what we do or is it part of the very core identity? Is it part of our very core identity? I have so many Divrei Torah to share with you, but we don't have time. I'll share with you so many source sheets about this that describe that the nature of Torah is it's a platform for living full time. Are we amateur Jews or professional Jews? What do our children see? What does the Almighty see? When we look in the mirror, what do we see about our Judaism? Are we casual? Cavalier? Are we part-time? I keep kosher at home, a little less so when I eat out. I daven when I remember when it's convenient. Halacha, I do the parts that make sense or that speak or resonate with me. I'm not telling you it's all or nothing, and of course a person needs to be in a path of growth. And Hashem appreciates whatever we do. This is not all or nothing. And Chas V'Shalom, God forbid, we are not sitting in judgment of others. But looking in that mirror and evaluating ourselves, if we're really willing to be honest and to confront that voice of resistance, we have to ask ourselves as we head into this holiday season, are we finally ready to become professional Jews or are we satisfied with being amateurs? Is our knowledge of the Parsha and Chumash the same way of where it was when we were 15 or 16 years old? Is our knowledge and experience of when we daven exactly where it was when we were 18 and 19 years old? Is our Judaism stuck in our adolescence or has it progressed? Has it become more sophisticated? Have we grown the older we've become? Have we turned more pro? Have we turned more pro? This is, after all, what we're saying every day right now in the David. Acha sha'alti meis Hashem, David HaMelech says, one thing I ask for you, osa avakeh shivti beveis Hashem, I want to sit kol yimei chayai. And the Slonim Rebbe and others ask, what do you mean kol yimei chayai? David HaMelech was a king. He had to lead a government. He had to be a warrior to fight wars. He had to legislate. David HaMelech couldn't sit in God's house kol yimei chayai all the days of his life. What did David HaMelech mean? So the Slonim Rebbe explains, you know what Kol Yimei Chayai means? Not that I stop everything I do and I sit in the base medrash or shul 24/7. It means when I go to work and when I go to the gym and when I go to the supermarket, wherever and whenever I am, Kol Yimei Chayai, Hashem, I want to see you. Lachzos benom Hashem levaker beichalo. I want to feel your presence. I want you to be with me. I want to be inspired by our relationship. I want to give you nachas ruach. I want to give you pride in me. Wherever and whenever. V'shinantam levanach v'dibar tabam. We teach our children. How and when do we teach our children? Not all the money and tuition when we send them to school. But b'shivtecha b'veisecha. What do they see us watch when we're at home? What do we do in our spare time? Are we amateurs or are we professional Jews? B'lechtecha b'derech. When we go on vacation. Remember back when you could go on vacation? When you go on vacation, when you're able to travel, do you leave God and Judaism behind and at home? B'shachbacha u'kumecha, what do we do when we fall asleep and when we wake up? Does Judaism permeate everything about our lives? Are we amateur or are we finally ready to turn pro? Shivchi kamayim libeich Hashem, I pour out my heart to you. Nochach p'nei Hashem. Our mission is to be nochach, to be opposite Hashem all the time, to feel close to and connected with and opposite Hashem all the time. It's who we are and who we're meant to be. The answer to overcome that voice of resistance is to finally turn professional, is to turn pro in our attitude and with the time and with the trainer and with the plan to make a resolution and to hold ourselves accountable to make those changes in our lives. We can all do it. We can all do it. I want to end. Last year we lost a great author, a great Jew, Hermann Wouk, who wrote so many world-famous books. And he had himself a very fascinating life story. He had a very, very interesting life story. And there was an article in a Jewish Action magazine that told the story of Hermann Wouk. He was raised by observant parents and much influenced by his learned grandfather from Minsk. But in his 20s, he began working as a radio scriptwriter and drifted away from observance. Eventually, he came under the influence of Rabbi Leo Young, the rabbi at the Jewish Center in Manhattan. And Wouk began accompanying the rabbi on his daily walk around Central Park. He wrote in 1996 piece for the Jewish Action, "We marched around the oval cinder path, enjoying the air and the view of the skyscrapers. We talked at length about ideas and commitments to Jewish faith." With World War II's approach, Hermann Wouk went off to the Naval Academy and did an extended tour of duty in the Pacific, keeping up a steady correspondence with Rabbi Young. At one point, Rabbi Young wrote to him the following, and I end with listen to Rabbi Young's words. And again, it's true and it's applicable in any area of our lives that we want to overcome that voice of resistance, but particularly about our Judaism, our relationship with Hashem and with others, our attitude towards Torah and mitzvahs and halacha. So Rabbi Young wrote to him, quote, "When you come back, you will have to make up your mind once and for all. Whether you want to travel the path of Torah through Judaism and its responsibilities, inconveniences, and the possible handicaps in your career, or whether you want to retain an emotional appreciation of Jewish faith and an attitude of appeasement and partial conformity. Decide once and for all on abiding loyalty to Din Torah and achieve that inner serenity which I know you are seeking." And indeed, Hermann Wouk did make up his mind, fully re-embracing Shmiras HaMitzvos. He became a fully observant Jew. What I love is that Hermann Wouk died, I think he was 103 years old when he died last year. And do you know how old he was when he published his last book? He was 101. I don't care how old you are. We're never done until it's over. He published his last book. He was 101 years old. It's never too late to become the person you were meant to be. It's never too late to live that unlived life inside us, to overcome that voice of resistance, to give it a name, and then to turn pro on it, to take it serious and to stop telling ourselves rational lies, stop rationalizing, stop seeing it as invisible, make a plan and set a path, a strategy, and take on accountability partners and measure your success with real metrics and put that voice of resistance in the rearview mirror. Wishing everyone a beautiful night. Ksiva v'chasima tova. May we succeed in overcoming resistance in our lives to live that unlived life to our fullest, to our fullest. Thank you for joining me. Please, 10 minutes behind the Bima. You can find it on our YouTube channel. Have a great night.